15 to 20 million.
Isn't it about time for a change?
We're our national leader.
AmericanWorkersRadio.com. You're listening to American Workers Radio, a national network promoting American-made products, with your host, Michael Blihash.
Well, welcome to another edition of American Workers Radio here on 860 AM, serving Philadelphia, southeastern Pennsylvania, the state of New Jersey, and northern Delaware. And I ask that you go to your telephone, invite family members and friends to tune in. We're going to have a great program today with a special guest. And also, if you're on the internet listening in, why not contact a friend and let them know that they can tune in from anywhere in the USA or anywhere in the world by going to AmericanWorkersRadio.com and click on the Listen Live link on the right-hand side of the page. Well, today in studio with me, I have the ever-famous Dr. Larkin Connolly, who is going to be doing a graduation of the students that he's been teaching for the last few months. And with me also, I have Rich Loges, who is a very popular gentleman, RJL Technology Integration Principal. And with Rich today is a very special guest. And I'm going to ask Rich to kindly ask our special guest, give him a little promo, and then ask him to say a few words.
Thanks, guys. Good morning, everyone. Larkin, good morning.
Good morning.
Happy to have you in.
I'm glad to be here.
I just wanted to mention, and we've got Bob Biersack on, and first to mention is we talk a lot on our show about Washington as a whole, politics as a whole, elections. I was introduced to Bob via some quotes I saw recently in a Yahoo article regarding campaign finance and the recent Supreme Court ruling on campaign finance. Bob, I want to ask two things. First, if you'd be so kind to tell us a little bit about your work with the Federal Election Commission.
Sure. First of all, it's good to be here. I spent 30 years at the Federal Election Commission, went straight really from graduate school. I was studying political science, getting a PhD. And it was a part of the political process that interested me, that I had worked on for a long time, how what the role of money is in campaigns and how we can find out about who's financing our elections as well as who's conducting them and who's winning them. And so I spent a long time basically trying to make sure that the commission was able to disseminate the information they get as fully and as understandably as possible. All the campaigns and political action committees and political parties that work on federal elections, so Congress or presidential campaigns, have to file regular reports with the FEC that list all of their contributions and all of their spending. In fact, many of them just did that yesterday for the first quarter of 2014. So there's information available now about what's happened in the last 3 months. But that material is obviously overwhelming. The forms are like IRS tax returns. They're very complicated, hard to work through. And so the commission has, for many, many years, computerized that information and then summarized it, you know, tried to make it approachable for people so that voters could understand what was happening. And that's mostly what I focused on. For several years, I worked very closely with the press, news organizations, reporters, because obviously they're part of the process, right? They're the ones who helped us make that information more available and more understandable. And so I spent my entire working life really focused on how can we help voters understand how this process works, who's giving money, who's getting money, and how that money affects elections nationwide.
And Bob, the organization you're with now is the Center for Responsive Politics, and I want to introduce listeners to the site for that center, opensecrets.org. And Bob, I want to give an example of something and ask you to talk about this broadly. It's a figure that I like to bring up a lot. In Obama v. Romney, according to opensecrets.org, and it's a site that I've really become familiar with, there was $6 billion spent. $6
billion. Right.
Approximately $400 million. Of that $6 billion The FEC admitted it does not know the source of those funds.
That's right.
So, Bob, in listening to you, in conversations we've had, I want to ask, and I hate to start our show on somewhat of a downer here, but are we really screwed? Where do we go from here? We're talking about campaign finance and what's happening now and where you see things going in the future.
Yeah, we should explain a little bit about why they don't know about that money.
Please.
What's happened over the last few years is there have been a number of court cases, Supreme Court decisions, that have changed the way the funding process worked. It used to be, up from the beginning of the 20th century, from 1907 until 2010, for example, it was not permitted for corporations or unions or trade associations, incorporated entities, organizations, to actually spend money directly in campaigns. They weren't allowed to run ads on television or the radio that said you should vote for this candidate or you should defeat this other candidate. The Supreme Court in 2010 overturned that restriction. So it said that corporations should be treated just like everybody else. They have First Amendment speech rights that allow them to say whatever they want, particularly in a political context. And so now, since then, these kinds of groups, companies, unions, trade groups, whatever, are allowed to spend the money they make in the marketplace directly on campaigns if they want to. The way they typically do that is not, you don't see ads sponsored by Amazon or General Electric or anybody like that talking about candidates. That's pretty controversial, so they don't like to do that. What they do instead is they give the money to what are called nonprofit social welfare groups that are often organized by political operatives, people who are skilled, old campaign workers, who then collect money from corporations or whoever and spend it on those kinds of advertising that say you should defeat this candidate or you should elect this candidate. They're the ads that you see all over television during the campaigns that often they will say, call your congressman and tell them to stop trying to kill Medicare or doing something else terrible. And they're paid for by groups that have innocuous names like Citizens for America or For American Values or whatever. The name doesn't tell you anything about who's behind it. So then they've worked this process in such a way that these groups now, they have to report if they make those expenditures, they have to disclose what they spent and where they spent it and who it was focused on, who it was attacking or who it was promoting. But because they're these social welfare kinds of groups, and because of some technicalities in the law, they don't actually have to report who gave them the money in the first place. So we have a big gap in that overall process where the goal was, essentially, you can as individual citizens or now as organizations, you can do what you want. You can spend your own money in just about any way in these campaigns. But if you do that, you have to own up to it. You have to declare that you've done that. You have to disclose who you are. Some of the most conservative judges on the Supreme Court, Antonin Scalia, for example, feels very strongly about that it's okay for anybody to do whatever they want, but you got to own up to it. You have to stand up. That hasn't worked out that way in the details. And so we have these gaps in this comprehensive kind of disclosure where the idea was that voters could make their own choices. Are we screwed by this? It's hard to know. It's hard to answer that question. What these changes have done, I think, is focus a lot more attention on a very small group of people or organizations that have a lot of money. The easiest way to raise funds is to go to the people who are rich, right? And so the focus of members of Congress or prospective even presidential candidates now more and more is about calling these people on the phone, asking for money in various different ways, for these outside groups going to them and soliciting contributions. And we're talking about really a very small group of people. There were 100 or so donors that we know about from 2012 that gave a very high percentage of the money that these outside groups spent. A few thousand contributors within the limits of giving directly to candidates, which is different from just spending your own money, who now, because of this decision a couple of weeks ago, now are able to give as much as a couple of $1 million in an election campaign spread out across all the parties and all the candidates, if they choose to try to influence these elections. So,
Bob, Larkin Connolly has a question for you.
Yeah, go ahead.
Bob, I didn't want to interrupt you, Your Honor.
Sorry, once I get wound up.
That's okay. That's okay.
Somebody's
got to stop me. Where does the AFL-CIO fit into this?
Well, they're kind of in the same category as companies are. It used to be that the way they worked in politics was they created a separate PAC. Every company is allowed to create a separate PAC, too, and the unions are as well. And so union members could voluntarily contribute usually small amounts to these political action committees, and then the PACs could contribute to candidates or even make these outside expenditures, these independent expenditures, if they wanted to. The difference now is they don't have to rely only on those voluntary contributions that members give. Now they can spend union members' dues money if they want to on political activities. They always did it on, often spent dues money on things like get out the vote drives, phone banks, calling people, encouraging them to vote for a particular candidate. Now they're able to be much more overt about that and spend the money on television ads if they want to.
In a lot of geographical areas I'm familiar with, especially the one I'm living in now, they actually endorse candidates.
Oh, sure. They always were able to endorse candidates. They could always go out to their members and talk about why this person's really important to you and so you should vote for them. That's not new. The difference really now is that they're able to use all of their collective resources, so all the dues money that members pay, to do anything they want virtually, as long as it's independent of the candidate, to go ahead and advertise on television more than just talk to their members about who they support.
So one last question. The OpenSecrets.org, does that have a political bent of any sort? Is there any?
No. We're absolutely nonpartisan. We don't take money from for-profit corporations. Our support comes from foundations, from individual people who contribute to us. And our goal there at Open Secrets is the same, really, as my goal as a worker at the FEC, which was to make sure people are aware of what's happening in ways that they can really get their hands around and understand who's giving to my congressman, who's spending money in my congressional race. And then you can judge it as you want. We don't really take a position that money's bad. It's certainly necessary. In order to get your message out, you're going to have to spend some money.
You know, Bob, when Larkin, thank you, Bob. When a lot of times in conversation, people say to me, "I don't know what my congressman's doing. What the hell is he doing? He doesn't seem like he's doing ever anything." I say, No. Our congressmen and women. It's like the old Batman series when Commissioner Gordon would get the phone call on the little red phone. Remember, he'd call Batman on the red phone. It would blink.
Yep.
That's the phone for congresspeople whose big donors call in. And as you pointed out, Bob, to me, and you made me think of it this way, not only is that happening, but, of course, those same congresspeople and their staff are also making those outbound calls to solicit all of those funds.
Yeah, you know there are special places in Washington, not far from the Capitol. They're not allowed. Candidates, members of Congress, are not allowed to solicit contributions on federal property. So they have to leave their office. So what they do is they go across the street to the Republican National Committee or the Democratic National Committee, whose offices are very close by, and they have basically phone bank operations in those buildings, where the members of Congress themselves will sit down in a little cubicle, put on a headset, and start calling donors and trying to raise money for their campaigns. And they do that for several hours every day they're in Washington.
Boy, I didn't know that, Bob, but I'll tell you, Rich, you just mentioned that the Batman phone. So, in other words, that is a entire office filled with Batman phones.
That's right. That's right. I mean, it's almost like the call centers that you have around the country for businesses, you know, that want to need to talk to their customers. It's the same idea. And that's how focused members feel like they have to be on raising money for their campaigns, that they'll take time out of just about every day they're in D.C. to go over there and make calls.
Now, Bob, I want to...
They're not calling, you know, just the regular folks in their neighborhoods and their constituencies. They're calling people in New York and California, people who have lots of money. And so they start creating relationships, right? They know these people. And so when somebody's got a problem and they're a big donor and they want to deal with some regulation or some tax questions or something like that, their calls get answered.
In essence, they're driven by the fact that they want to be reelected. I mean, there's nothing that they do that's more important than that. You know, serving in Congress is an honor. It was never meant to be a career. You know, the founding fathers envisioned legislators as being citizen legislators. And serving their terms in Congress and then going home and going back to work.
That's right. In fact, you know, Bob, as I was listening to you, I thought to myself, hearing all this, what goes on regarding getting the money to stay in office, really takes 99% of your time away from really dealing with your constituents. And that's where the big problem comes in. If someone says to me, yes, I did hear from my congressman or my senator or my local senator or local House of Representatives, you'll never hear them asking, well, how are your jobs in the area and what can I do to help bring more jobs to the area? But what they're asking for is, I'm running for reelection. Can you help me?
It takes away from everything else they do. It's hard being a member of Congress. You got to know a lot about a lot of different things. They're constantly facing decisions about legislation or about policy going forward. How do we improve education? How do we deal with health care? All kinds of really, really important questions. And it's a very, very tough job, very challenging.
And Bob, I want to ask you this. As you're saying they're worrying about education, I see on the chart that our educational standards in America have dropped while other countries have gone ahead. What do you think we can motivate them to do to get away from the bat phones and really get back into the legislative end of things so that we can get jobs back here in the USA, get that education to train the boys, girls, and everybody together so that we would have some skills returned to the country? Because there's nothing worse than industries coming back and saying, I'm sorry, I would bring more of the jobs back. I can't find skilled people. Yet our legislators are in Washington. They're doing 1,001 things. I see them once in a while on C-SPAN, and I often wonder to myself, what are we talking about in the way of bringing taxpayers to work so they'll be able to pay the taxes that you boys and girls are trying to put upon us?
Those are big economic challenges, and they have lots of elements to them. Education's a really important one. Workforce preparedness, all kinds of things that are critical for going forward effectively, for having a real good, strong economy going forward. And a lot of people around the world are focused on that. There's a lot more competition these days globally than there used to be. So it's a harder job. One element of it, and I don't necessarily want to overstate it, but one element of this process is the ability of people in decision-making places like Congress to be able to really focus their time and energies on those kinds of questions. There are lots of different ways that you can try to I don't know if necessarily reduce the effect of money in the electoral campaigns. I'm not sure that's possible. But there are ways that you can get more sources involved in the process and so that you're less dependent maybe on these very small group of people who are very wealthy and willing to give. There's some experiments around the country. New York City, for example, as a partial public funding program for their local elections for city council and other local offices, where they will match a small contribution. I think if you give up to $150 to a candidate in New York, the city matches that money $6 to one. So that people are able, candidates for office are able to spend more time in their constituencies, going to meetings of local groups around the community where they want to serve, and actually talking to them about their concerns and about moving forward, and also asking them to participate in the campaign in a small way, even giving some money, because they know those small contributions will add up, and because they get matched and multiplied. And there's good research that shows now that candidates for office in New York spend a lot more time in their constituencies than they do in Manhattan, where they used to have to go, you know, downtown to Wall Street or midtown to wealthy people and go to fundraisers all the time.
I you know, Bob, from what I've seen over the years, I would like to see 90% of all the elected officials' time spent doing constituent work and have some providers or people to do the fundraising for them. Because right now we're in a situation in America, our nation's in debt. We need an educational system that'll educate our youth so that they'll be able to go and be skilled in one of a dozen items in school so they can go into the workforce. And yet, that's the last thing on the list. I know when political people come, even in the Philadelphia area, it's rush in, rush out because I got to go to a fundraiser. It's simply inappropriate. But I'm going to ask all of you to hold on because I have to acknowledge a few of our sponsors. And the next portion of our broadcast today is being presented by Yolanda Konopatska DeCipio, attorney at law, and she invites you to give her a buzz at 215-423-4824. And also by Mr. Frank Spula, the president of the Polish National Alliance. And they are a national organization founded originally in Philadelphia, now located in all 50 states. To contact them, give them a call at 215-261-3723. And also the office of Dr. Włodzimierz Zinn in Everest Dental is located at 9892 Busselton Avenue in Northeast Philadelphia, and he always provides quality services at an affordable price. For more information, call Dr. Zinn at 215-671-0188. And Martin Bednarek, who is the president of the Washington Savings Bank, Kazimierz Wielki, takes this opportunity to wish all of you a very happy holiday, Wesołe Świąt, and remind you that they have 5 locations in Philadelphia to serve all of your needs. Give them a call at 215-698-9400, and whenever you stop at any of our sponsors, make sure you let them know that you hear about them on American Workers Radio. And also, Mr. Jan Majewski, who is the president and CEO of Giorgio Foods, a symbol of quality since 1928, reminds you to look for Giorgio where you shop, and also Wesołe Świąt. And Net Cost Market Philadelphia is located at 117,001 Busselton Avenue. That's at the Leo Mall in Northeast Philadelphia, where you'll always find a great selection of European style products, meats, groceries, dairy, beverages, and sweets, and so much more. Check it all out at Net Cost Market. And also a very faithful sponsor, someone who's always with us in the community, is Mr. Leon Mankowski, attorney at law, and he's located at 2624 East Allegheny Avenue in the Port Richmond section of Philadelphia. For more information, give him a call at 215-739-8521. Well, let's get back to our panelists, Larkin Connolly, Mr. Rich Logis, Dr. Logis, and our special guest, Bob Bierschak. I am Michael Bleihaus, your host. And let's get back into hearing about this commission that Bob works with. I'm very pleased to hear what goes on. It gave me a better perspective of how important the money is in government and in our election process.
Bob, I'm the, I guess I should admit, I suppose I'm maybe the resident utopian guy, and Sir Thomas More was beheaded after writing Utopia, so I hope I fare better. But what is the, if you had to talk in a broad sense now and moving forward, I've long supported publicly financed elections. And as I'm listening to you talk about the raising of money and your work, I feel like I'm listening to a Fortune 10 financial company with CFOs and marketing, and we're talking about government, and we're not talking about just federal. Why pick on just those guys and gals, right? They're state and local who are doing the same thing, albeit on a smaller financial scale, but really doing the same thing. So what are the, where do we go in the sense of, is it just a total pipe dream to think that the voters will eventually really demand from Congress to make our elections entirely publicly financed? No $20,000 plate fundraisers, no taking the private jets, no, as Michael said, running off to the fundraisers. Or is there maybe a better compromise that you think of, where money will come in, but it will be perhaps not quite as influential as it's been?
I guess at Open Secrets, we really don't take a position on those kinds of questions. It's really up to people on their own to decide how they think politics should be organized. I like the idea, the second idea you have, the idea that we're going to completely publicly finance our campaigns. That's a pretty heavy lift, I think, because people are pretty skeptical about what you're really talking about there in sort of the grossest terms is my tax money being used to finance somebody's campaign where I don't agree with them. I don't want them to get elected, and so why should my money go to that? There's a bigger kind of community argument for why that might be a good idea, but it's a hard sell. People don't feel like that's a good use of their resources. So I guess I think of it in terms of how can we devalue the money? How can we make all of this spending less important in the process? Or are there things that are happening that make it possible for smaller donors, for people who of modest means to really be involved in a good way? So that's why I talked about New York as an example of how that can work. There's another example, though, that's just about technology. The way we live our lives now is a lot different than it used to be. The example is the 2008 campaign when Barack Obama first ran for president. He raised more money in contributions from people who were giving basically $25 at a time over the Internet than anyone, myself certainly included, but I think anyone, would have ever believed was possible before. Nobody thought that could happen. He raised hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in important amounts in very small contributions from people because they got engaged and because they could do it. They could go to a website and click a button and give $25. And if something happened during the campaign that got them upset or got them energized and they wanted to do more, they could go back and give another $25. And it was very inexpensive for the campaign to set up that process because the technology is a lot better now. And it was inexpensive for the person to do it. In the old days, what you got was a letter in the mail from lots of people were good at this, direct mail fundraising. Ronald Reagan was a great direct mail fundraiser. But you'd get a piece of a letter in the mail that said, I really need your help, please give me money. You'd write a $25 check. You had to sit down and write that check. You had to put it in the envelope. You had to put a stamp on it. You had to go to the post office and mail it or wherever. That's what I mean by it was costly for people to do that. It took time and effort. Now it's just so much easier. So I think there are a couple of possibilities. One of them is that as we become more comfortable, as this way of doing things, you know, you buy everything on Amazon and you pay your bills electronically, you do everything on your computer. As that continues to develop, it's going to be natural, and it's also generational. Young people that's the way they live their lives.
Absolutely.
And so they're going to do that more. So I'm hopeful on some level that there'll be new abilities for people to who can give just $25 or $50 to be really much more important in the process because the technology will change.
And Obama was the first one to really mobilize the youth of America and reached out to them using technology, which no president or candidate had done prior.
That's right, it's not just because he was Barack Obama. There were aspects of his personality and his way of that he communicated that certainly lit the fuse, that set the spark for that. But it's out there for anybody to do. It doesn't. It's not partisan at all. It's not ideological at all. It's just the ability to use those new techniques of talking to people and getting them to participate, and I think it's laying out there for anybody.
So, Mr. Biersack, I have reached into my briefcase and pulled out my magic wand. I'll send you a picture of it, but it does work. If I whack you in the head with it, whatever you regurgitate instantly is going to be a change in the rules and the laws. And I guess what I'm driving at is, what would you do tomorrow morning if you were allowed to instantly pass a rule or regulation that would set us in the right direction?
Oh, I think there's no question that the first thing, step one, is to make sure we close these gaps in disclosure so that at a minimum we know who's doing what to whom. And the games that people are playing now with these different kinds of organizations that can spend the money and filter money through one to another to another to another so nobody can find the original source, that's got to stop. And so if I were king for a day, the first thing I would do would be to make sure that it's a simple rule. If you're doing something in an election campaign, you got to disclose what you did and where the money came from. Beyond that, I think rules that encourage candidates, parties, and other kinds of organizations to go looking more broadly for resources, whether it be volunteers or support or financial support, to anything that encourages them to get out of this little zone of very small number of people and broaden their bases is a good step. And there are lots of things that could help to encourage that.
So we had a guest a couple, 3 weeks ago. He's the current mayor of Allentown, Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Great politician, and he has done some things in Allentown that have truly made him stand out on a national basis. And we were delighted to have him on. Somebody on the panel made the suggestion of, would he consider running for governor? And he said, what do you mean? Would I consider it? I announced. And I, in fact, was a candidate for governor. It lasted about 7 weeks because the Democratic side is very crowded because the incumbents are Republican. Mm-hmm. And the second or third guy to get in is a very successful businessman from York, Pennsylvania, who announced publicly, as he announced his candidacy, that he was spending $10 million of his own money to get elected governor. Our great mayor of the city of Allentown said, it's nice knowing you guys. I can't compete with that. And he withdrew.
See, Bob, that's where I believe there has to be some sort of a way to pull money, that we shouldn't have our elected leaders running over to rooms where they're going to be on phones for 2 hours. I would rather see them finding ways to get jobs here in the USA, finding ways to get tax cuts for the businesses to stay here, bring those incentives back, not just look to be reelected. Most of the Congress people and the senators, quite frankly, have never physically seen constituents that live within 10 miles of their home. That's a sad statistic.
Bob, I want to ask you about your point earlier about the challenge, in your opinion, that perhaps the challenge of publicly financed elections because of taxes, right? When we talk about the government, when I hear people say the government doesn't have anything, right? It doesn't pay for anything. It must get funding from somewhere or places to fund. So the challenge about that, I want to ask you something, Bob, and I might stand corrected on this, and I'm going to defer to you on this question, but with all of the money, I'm not talking about just the presidential election, but with all of the money, it seems hard to believe that there aren't somewhere or some places, perhaps loopholes, that businesses can even get some significant tax write-offs. I understand that individual contributions, those $25 you mentioned, or a $2,500, which I think is the max for an individual. I know those are not tax deductible, but you got a lot of businesses, a lot of unique corporate entities. I've got to think they're also writing some things off, but I might be mistaken on that.
I'm not a tax attorney, so I don't really know exactly. They can't, if they're just giving contributions, donations to groups to spend money, those are not standard business expenses. So I don't think they get a tax deduction for that. But there are things they can do that would be perhaps write-offs as business expenses that maybe would be different. I'm just not sure exactly how the details work there.
And, Bob, I should mention also that with public – and this is a different show, different conversation. The financing of campaigns is also very directly interconnected with ballot access, term limits like Larkin mentioned before. It's very clear the two major parties have co-conspired for years to keep other parties, other candidates off ballots. So I'm not suggesting, Bob, I want to clarify this, I'm not suggesting that any person can just go down to the local election office and say, well, I'm running for Congress, give me $10 million, or I'm running for president, give me X amount of money.
Right.
So I'm not suggesting that, but just to play devil's advocate here for a moment, what's wrong with public finance? I mean, think about it in the sense of democracy. What's the problem with that idea? Or do you think
we had that system in presidential campaigns from 1976 until really 2004. Certainly it stopped in 2008, and it had a couple of components to it. Basically what happened is when candidates were running in primaries before the conventions, before they settled on a particular candidate for each party, you could get matching funds if an individual gave you a contribution up to $250, then it was matched dollar for dollar out of this fund that was on your tax form. Do you want to contribute $1, now it's $3, to the presidential election fund? And if you check the box and say, yeah, I want $3 to go there, then that's what it was for. So in the primaries, you got matching funds. So if you were successful and you raised money, and it didn't start with, you know, the first anybody walked in the door could get it. You had to meet certain thresholds to show that you were a serious candidate before you could get the money. But then it started in that way. And if you were successful, and Jimmy Carter, who was elected president, would tell you to this day that he would not have been president of the United States if it wasn't for that system, that it helped him. It helped him decide to run, and it helped him stay viable during the primary campaign. Then, after the conventions, when there was one nominee for each party, there was a fixed amount of money, a grant, basically an equal amount that went to each one, and that was all the money that the candidates themselves could spend between that day, which usually is the end of August, first part of September, and Election Day on their direct campaigning. It was not a perfect system. The grants turned out to be – they were adjusted for inflation, so they grew over time, but it ended up being – it sounds like a lot of money. In 2004, the last time anybody took that grant – I'm sorry, 2008, the last time anybody took that grant was John McCain, and he got $85 million on the day after he was nominated at his convention, and that's the money he spent from that day forward to Election Day.
And that's the money you're saying, Bob, that came from checking off on your income tax.
That's right. That's right.
So that was free will donations. Now, I would prefer that people have to use those types of dollars rather than spending most of their life sitting by the bat phones trying to raise money.
Right,
because
sure.
I can't see in working in community level organizations, I really can't see where the elected officials are going out of their way to have any type of contact with the general public. It's always a little press release or something. And when you do invite them, or they just say, well, we're busy, I'm predisposed. It's a thousand and one reasons why they are not going to be able to participate. Can you hold on? I have a few more sponsors that I would like to acknowledge. Our next portion of the broadcast is being presented by Polka Deli, and you know this is the time of Easter holiday goodies. Why don't you go to Polka Deli? They're located at 2719 East Allegheny Avenue in Port Richmond. Give them a call at 215-634-3750. And Mr. Chester Kshanovsky, who is the owner of Seden Ozoro Body Shop, reminds you they have two locations to serve you. One is at 6201 Oxford Avenue in Northeast Philadelphia. The other one is at 691 Bethlehem Pike in Montgomeryville, Pennsylvania. For more information, call Sedena's Auto Body Shop at 215-535-6606. And Mr. Joseph Drobot, who is the national president of the PRCUA, the Polish Roman Catholic Union of America, reminds you that they have life insurance plans, annuities, paternal benefits, and so much more. For more information, you can call their main office. They are also located throughout the United States of America. Give them a call at 1-800-772-8632 or visit them on the internet at prcua.org. And Karen Janad wants to remind you that she handles auto, home, and life insurance. For more information, give her a call at 215-862-5490. And Mr. Michael Steinman, a very faithful member of our community, has two offices to serve you in the Philadelphia area. One is at 17th and JFK Boulevard. The other is at 8510 Busselton Avenue. For more information, call Michael Steinman at area code 215-322-0235. And if you are planning to do some travel, remember the Polish American Travel Service is located at 2714 East Allegheny Avenue. That's at Tilton and Allegheny Avenue in the well-known Port Richmond section of Philadelphia. For more information, give Polish American Travel a call at 215-634-3396. And we want everyone to look great and smile even better. And you can do that by going to Dr. Eva Maciak, who has two dental offices in Philadelphia, to serve you. For more information, give her a call at 215-739-2787. And don't forget, also, this is the holiday season. Get on over to the NetCost Philadelphia Market, located at 117,001 Busselton Avenue, for a complete selection of great food and a European experience.
And speaking of looking your best, Phil's Hairstyling is located at the corner of Richmond and Orthodox Streets in the Bridesburg section of Philadelphia. Their experienced, friendly staff are there to serve you 6 days a week, specializing in any type of style for men, women, and children. Waxing and facial services are also available. Contact them today at 215-535-8997 or stop in at 4401 Richmond Street and tell them American Workers Radio sent you. Also, Pat's Auto Tags would like to wish everybody a very, very happy holiday season. They have three convenient locations to serve you. For all of your licensing, notary, identification cards, specialty plates, and much, much more. They are located at 2536 East Allegheny Avenue on the corner of Belgrade and Allegheny in the Port Richmond section, which has a direct link to the DMV. Call 215-427-1832. Also, 5501 Harbison Avenue at the corner of Harbison and Sanger Streets. And their location at 400 East Allegheny Avenue, where you can contact the on-site insurance broker, Cliff Hutchins, who represents Progressive and 10 other insurance companies. You can contact Cliff at 215-423-5266. Their locations are open from Monday to Friday, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m., and Saturday, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. The Liberty Bell Diner, located at 8445 Frankfurt Avenue in the beautiful Northeast Philadelphia, wishes everyone a very happy and healthy holiday season. Halil Michael and his staff are avid supporters of our American Workers Radio program, as well as National Small Business Weekend. They have all-day delivery available. Give them a call today at 215-331-4344 or stop in for your next meal, and we guarantee you will not be disappointed. And now that summer's coming, you can visit their walk-up window for your favorite water ice and ice cream treats.
Very good. Thank you so much, Stephen. And now let's get back to our guest, which I am going to pose this question. Now, Bob, we heard an awful lot about what the political people are doing to raise money for their continuation in office. But do you hear in the process of their workmanship, are they doing anything to help jobs? Are they going to the bat phones that talk to major corporations to also bring jobs back to the USA? In addition to them doing their thing to raise money?
Oh, I think all of them are concerned about those questions. They have different ideas about how to approach that. The two parties have pretty different perspectives on that. But one of the things that happens in the system is part of the way they look at those kinds of questions and part of the way they approach solutions depends on who they hear from, who gives them advice, who gives them information about policy choices, about the way they might proceed to improve industries, to grow the economy, to make jobs more available and broader in the country. And that gets you back to who do they know, who do they trust, whose information is most accessible to them, because as we know, they're pressed for time. And the answer to that often has something to do with where that campaign money comes from. So it becomes this kind of vicious circle, and a smaller and smaller sort of whirlpool of, I know you because you gave me money and you own a business, or you're in an association that has advocates for certain kinds of things, and so I'll take your call, I'll listen to you, and it shapes how I think about issues. And so that's really, I think, another example of how this process.
Bob, one of the things I would just like to add, and I'm going to ask Richard to add to this too, is that as we look at the United States debt clock over the last 10 years, say 12 years, it's right on the front of our page, American Workers Radio. Right now, America has a population of 317 million people. Of that 317 million, 145 million people are working. Normally, in any society, you should have enough jobs for at least 58-60% of your people. That's boys and girls in high school through people ready to be retired and even retired and having full-time jobs. When I look at the fact that we have 145 million people working and we should have 185 million people working, it makes me wonder and it has me concerned as to what exactly these national people are focusing their time on. If we don't have people in a job, we're just having them sit around and get us more social programs from the government rather than having the people work, pay the taxes, and be able to support themselves. And when you look, I'm going to ask that you kindly look at the U.S. debt clock, and all of our listeners, I'm going to ask you, because right now we have 46 million people on food stamps, 47 million people living in poverty, and we have so many people, 91 million people that are not in the workforce. And those people are, some are pre-retired, some are retired. Many of them have no jobs or can't find jobs, can't find skills, and they can't get in touch with their national elected officials because they're too busy doing other things.
Bob, I want to just echo something you said, and I don't doubt, and I've said this before, I don't doubt that members, we'll just use Congress here for a moment, are day-to-day trying to at least do some things regarding economy, jobs, labor. How successful they're doing that is a different discussion. But I have an idea, Bob, and I want to bounce it off you here. And I think it might be one of the most innovative ideas in the history of American democracy. I say the person who raises the most amount of money gets the position. Do away with elections, primaries, debates. Who needs that? Just get that person into office. What do you think? Good plan?
Well, I'll walk you back a little bit from that. I like the old Beatles lyric that money can't buy you love. And there are a lot of examples. You talked a little bit earlier about somebody who was thinking about running for governor, but the opponent said, "Well, I'm going to put in $10 million of my own money," and so this person backed out. The problem with that logic is sometimes a really rich person will run for office, and the more they put themselves out there, the more voters look at them and see their ads on television or whatever, or watch them. In different ways, the more they think, boy, I just don't want this person. They're no good. And you can't buy your way out of that. So I don't, and there are lots of examples of that. So I don't want to leave the impression that it's just the money. It is generally true that the person who spends the most money, raises the most money, usually wins. But there are other kinds of reasons for that, and there are lots of other factors. And if you get in trouble, if you're a member of Congress or you're some other elected official and you get involved in some sort of scandal or something happens, or you just lose touch with your constituents, there comes a point where you can't buy your way back from that.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I'm not quite as cynical and hopeless about the place of money in the process, as your proposal suggests.
Let me clarify, I don't mean it. I'm glad you pointed out something that we talk a lot about on this show, which is voter responsibility. The civic duties of voters do not end with voting. They start there. And I say all the time that the average American needs to really think about actually just how good we have it here politically. You look elsewhere around, you look at Ukraine, you look at Egypt, these places can't go to the polls to change things. It's why there's violence in these kinds of things. We can do that. We can do that civilly. We actually have it quite good here. But if you've got that power as voters and you don't, either you don't do anything with it or you only do a little bit with it, we're not realizing the potential. And it is, in my opinion, Bob, there's no doubt whatsoever that unlimited amounts of money that can come into elections shut out pretty much everybody. Because what that money also allows the two parties to do is to block ballot, just like the Democrats have blocked ballot access to Ralph Nader, the way that Mitt Romney did it to Gary Johnson in 2012. These funds, Bob, are not really always used for the best of purposes. Would you agree with that?
No, yeah, sure, that's right. And the parties are always going to try to fight off other competitors. They have a shared interest in keeping control of ballot access and things like that. There's no question about that.
So why is competition bad in elections, according to the two parties? Who will say, that's not true, Rich. We have competition. We have primaries. I mean, it's like McDonald's, though. 10 hamburgers, it's all the same 10. So why is competition bad?
Well,
why
what is, they would say is the best way to move politics forward is to find coalitions, right? And so parties are a good way of bringing lots of different points of view together and finding some shared common perspective and building a bigger tent to move forward.
Bob, I have a big question for you. Do you ever believe you will see, working at that commission, anyone propose term limits?
Oh, there are term limit proposals all the time, and at the state level in different states they exist. I'm not persuaded that term limits are such a good idea. What you end up with there are a lot of legislators who aren't really familiar with the mechanics of the legislative process, which can be pretty complicated. And so you end up giving a lot of power to staffers, to people who work for the legislature, young kids very often, But they, at least they stay in the job for a little while, and so they learn the ropes and figure out how it works. And so I'm not opposed to somebody being in office for a fairly long period of time, as long as they're gaining skills and developing the kinds of strategies that move policy forward and become really effective legislators.
See, one of the problems, Bob, in many of the elected offices is when the elected person leaves, they take the staff with them. In
right.
other areas, they have civil servants. So if the elected person goes, they still have a lion's share of the people who are civil servants.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another way of looking at it, because right now it seems that I see from my own experience, many of the people you contact are not available. Their schedule is packed. And I now have a better idea where few hours a day are spent. It's not in the Capitol. It's across or near the Capitol, raising funds for themselves or other candidates. And that's really not what we sent them to Washington to do. That's not what we're paying them to do. That's not why they're receiving a pension. It is the reason we're $17 trillion in debt, and we need about 47 million jobs in America to bring us back to where we should be.
It certainly all contributes to that.
Bob, I'm going to ask you to come back with us at another time in the future. Our ad is coming back to all of what we're trying to do is go back to the people and ask them to support American workers. We have a lot of work to do. We have a lot of industries that are closed. We have to wake those industries up again. We don't have a national elected leaders helping us out. And I'd really like to see them put more of their time and effort to doing their job as elected officials rather than to just spend their time doing whatever they choose to do. With that, gentlemen, we are coming near the end of our broadcast today. Bob Bierschak, I want to thank you for tuning us in and being with us from your location. And Rich Logis, I want to wish you my very best and thank you for bringing this great guest to us. And Rich, my very best to you and your family. And thank you, Larkin, as well, who had to go to the graduation ceremony. And I'm Michael Blihash, and I want to say best wishes for a very happy holiday. I see we have the Batman. Hey, Rich, we got the Batman music in the back.
I love it.
I need that bat phone. What I need is a bat phone in my office. Maybe I could do some calls, and maybe that bat phone would bring me some good luck. But, Bob, thank you so much. Rich, Larkin, Henry, Stephen, very best. Have a great holiday. Bożego Narodzenia. Wesołego Alleluja. Have the very best.
Thank you, everyone.